I'd like to give you an overview of what I'd like to cover this morning. Five major points. First of all, we're going to talk about why organize. Secondly, we're going to talk about some principles of organizing. Third, we're going to talk about some how-tos, how to organize. Fourth, we're going to come back and talk about job descriptions. And fifth, we're going to talk about delegation. Now, it'd be my aim that you'll see how each of these tie in basically to the concept of how to organize. 5 points. Why organize? Principles of organizing. How to organize from a plan. That was the third one. Job descriptions and delegation. Let's open in prayer. Father, thank you for your Spirit using each of us. Thank you, Lord, that you have provided this time as a time of learning. And we look forward to what you're going to do as a result of this week. Thank you again for your Son and what he means to each of us. In Christ's name, amen. I'd like to open up with a definition of organizing. First of all, it's a process of placing people into a structure to accomplish objectives. Let me go over that one more time. It's a process of placing people into a structure to accomplish objectives. That's all organizing is. We're taking a look at this process. And we're going to put some people into this structure to accomplish our objectives. I want you to note these 4 key words in the definition, and let's look at some implications of these words. First of all, a process implies a dynamic activity. This is not a static, once and for all, etched in stone organization. Organizing is a process. Secondly, people is talking about real live people. People that you look at and run into every day that have hang-ups, that have hopes, aspirations. So we're going to be talking about that. We're going to be talking about a structure which will essentially show how these people relate to each other. And then in the objectives, we want to make sure that that's the only reason we're organizing. No other reason. We want to have fellowship. That's great. Let's don't organize. But if we want to accomplish objectives, let's organize. Now, I think you'll see some of the reasons behind this. You know, I've really been looking forward to this day, and I have an ulterior motive. If I waited too much longer, all the other speakers would take my illustration. It's about time I got up here. I'd like to talk about why organize now. Why do we need to organize? And I'd like to refer to a familiar passage we just covered. But I think we'll be bringing out some complimentary things. Okay, I would like to hit on a slightly different slant on the situation in Acts. It takes a lot of nerve, doesn't it? I think we'll come out at the same point, though. I hope so. First of all, I'd like to take a look at some numbers in this whole situation of the church growing. If you look in Acts 1, verse 15, we get a number. It says a gathering of about 120 persons were there together. I call that the hardcore element. Well, notice this is probably in addition to the 12, so if you threw that in there, you'd probably have 132 people that were waiting there before Pentecost came. Now, that's still a pretty good group, pretty good size group, but we'll notice they're not really organized. They're just getting together, and they're not doing a whole lot other than having some fellowship and prayer and praying, looking forward to what God's going to do. Then if you look in chapter 2, verse 41, we'll notice that when Peter finishes his address, that there is added 3,000 souls. I assume there's a body with each of the souls, so that gives us 3,000 people. And so let's keep track of the figures now. We got 3,332. And now let's see what this 3,332 people are doing. In verses 46 and 47 of chapter 2, it says, "And day by day, continuing with one mind in the temple, and breaking bread from house to house, they were taking their meals together with gladness and sincerity of heart." And then in verse 47, it says, "They were also increasing their numbers every day." Well, that means a certain amount of one-on-one, I guess. Somebody was out talking to some other people. So we have over 3,000 people. They were together for fellowship, teaching, breaking bread, praying, and evangelism. Well, as if... Now, that's a pretty good-sized group. That's more than we have on staff altogether now. And still, there's relatively little organizing. It's still just kind of moving out. I imagine there's some informal organization, but nothing really formal yet. Now, if 3,000 wasn't enough, let's see what happens after Peter holds his Jerusalem Classic. You've heard of the Jerusalem Classic. That's where he healed a guy who was lame from birth to draw a crowd. And then he presented Christ, and we have verse 4 of chapter 4. I'm sorry? Yes, that's right. Verse 4 of chapter 4. We had 5,000 more people. And it says essentially that they kind of joined into the body. Now, how many people do we have? Well, after an engineering degree and many years in math, I add that up to about 8,000, a little over 8,000 people. And that's a lot of people. And it continues to emphasize that they just weren't doing their own things, but they were coming together for some common activities. And you can understand then, that's a setup for Acts 6:1, you can understand why when this problem came up, they realized that they needed to set aside, as Dr. Hendricks mentioned, some people to do some certain things. Now, we also see that later on as the church begins to grow, and as persecution comes along, by the way, let me add here that in Acts 6, you'll notice that organization did cause them to be more effective in Jerusalem. They were getting the job done better. But you notice right after that, Stephen gets stoned, and then they're dispersed. And here's the point. Persecution did what organization could never have done. Persecution got the people out there. Organizing got them to do what they were doing more effectively. So that's an interesting thought. Organizing is not the panacea for increasing the numbers in our church necessarily. It will help us do our job better, and therefore we should be increasing. But as far as dramatic movements where we begin to step out in faith, persecution had to come in to get the troops out there. Then we see also as the group begins to grow that they had need to take another step in organizing, and that's where they came up with the council in Jerusalem. So you begin to see this emphasis again that they were meeting needs through their organizing. Now, we'll talk about that later in more detail. Now, I just want to throw in a PS here because as we continue to grow in numbers, I've heard the question tossed around many times, well, you know, if we keep growing larger, it's going to get awful. It's not going to get personal anymore. We're just going to have so many staff people around that you're not really going to know one another, and we're going to become just a dead organization. Well, let's see what happened in Acts when they added these two clumps of big groups. We think 1,000 is a big number, but if you look at Acts 2:44, it says, this is right after they had added the 3,000 into their number. It says, "And all those who had believed were together and had all things in common." And I'm thinking that means that even though they had 120 pretty close when they added the 3,000, they still had a commonality. They were still close together in one mind and one spirit. And then after they added 5,000, we look at Acts 4:32. It says essentially, "And the congregation," now this is right after the 5,000 had been added. We've got about 8,000 now. Now, there would have been some that tubed, and you'd throw in your percentages as to the number you would expect would stay with you, but you still got a large number. Acts 4:32, it says, "And the congregation of those who believed were of one heart and soul." That whole mass of people, approaching much more than we have on staff, or we will have for several years, was of one heart and soul. So my point would be that we do not need to expect depersonalization as we continue to grow in size. because it didn't happen here in Acts. And I think it only happens as carnality and as we become not tuned in to people. As we become tuned into the organization and forget people, we can expect us to lose that personalization which they had in Acts. Now, I'd like to take a look at some of the results of lack of organization. First of all, now this is any situation, and we're still talking about why we need to organize. First of all, when you aren't organized, every single time you'll have duplication of effort. Now, it may not be exactly the same thing that the other guy's doing, but it'll be so close that you'll have duplication of efforts. The second point, under results of lack of organization, you can expect confusion every single time. The third point, you can expect frustration among people in the organization. I think you can have frustration from any number of the cause can come from any number of ways. Something wrong in a guy's life will cause frustration. But if you're not organized, I'm convinced that if we're poorly organized, that actually becomes a temptation to a person. And it causes him to sin if he succumbs to the temptation. So frustration, I think, enters in when there's a result of lack of organization. Another point, you see this every time. You see aggressive people take over work they should not perform. It's not their fault, they're just geared that way. And if you're not organized, you'll have people trying to build empires. And they're not that much aware of it. The problem is there's nobody else that's telling them, this is how you need to focus. So they're going off at all fronts. And they're trying to build their own little empire. That's another characteristic of lack of organization. My fifth point, important work is often undone. See if you can identify with this phrase. I thought that was your job. No, I thought that was your job. No, that was your... Does that sound familiar? Well, when you're not organized, you can expect that to happen. The really important tasks are often undone. Then I've got a sixth point. I call it the tornado effect. And that means when you've got, you're always having emergencies, and for the amazing fact is, though, it's hard to identify a cause. You're just having all kind of emergencies happening all the time, and it's hard really to say what the cause is. Kind of like a big flurry of activity, and everybody's running all over the place. As Steve was talking about the other day, putting out fires. But you don't know really what the cause is. And a lot of the causes can be traced back to lack of organization. So that's my tornado effect. Now, I think organization, now we're still talking about why we need to organize. I think it helps us answer some very natural questions that each person has. By the way, I use Steve Douglas as my model for all these diagrams. Got a hold of some baby pictures. Steve and I have a good relationship. Okay, let's look at some of the things that organization tries to do as far as answering some natural questions. You know, you're a person, you come into the organization and you've got natural questions on your mind when you come in. What is my job? What are my responsibilities? Exactly, what am I supposed to be doing? Say, could you tell me who my director is? And say, it's middle of the year now. I've just been wondering who reports to me. So these are natural questions that will always exist in a person's mind, and we attempt through organization to answer some of these questions. Now the question is, does organizing limit my freedom of action? I don't know how many times I hear this, and you know, an interesting thing about management textbooks, they rarely hone in on the important issues, controversial issues. Does organizing limit my freedom of action? And I say unequivocally, yes. But, in the following manner, I think it's just like a highway limits your freedom of action when you're driving an automobile. Let's take a look at this just a minute and see if we can bring some points out of it. First of all, you'll notice that when you get on the highway, you can drive off into sticks over here, but you find it much easier to stay on the road. Now, an organization, you can definitely go off different sides, but you'll find that it's usually better to try to stay on the road where it's already paved. In other words, it's already laid out. You'll notice also that a car has complete freedom between this line and this line. Now, if you have a very small car, you have more freedom. If you have a large car, you don't have as much freedom. But the point is, this center line is there to separate you from a guy coming this way, and you're going this way. Well, here's a guy trying to do his job, and he needs to have some guidelines to work on or work with. You need some guidelines, too. And unless somebody says what these guidelines are, it's a chance you're going to run right into each other. So we see that in organizing, we're attempting to provide some constraints, but very helpful constraints. Constraints that will enable you to have complete freedom within this area and not run into this guy. So you see that we do have that center line for that reason. Also, let's look at this gas station over here. Gas station's there when you're running out of gas, like I do typically in my car. You can pull in there and get your gas and have it filled up. Well, in an organization, it's the same type of principle. You're out in the field, and you're working towards your objective here. And here's headquarters. Now, I don't know what kind of gas station headquarters would be, but hopefully it would be the kind of gas station that would supply your needs so that you can function well out on the field. Again, another idea that organizing does limit your freedom, but it always works to help you. And then the interesting thing about getting on a road is, if you stay on that road, you end up in L.A. No way you can end up in San Francisco if you're on the road going to L.A. Now, at any time, you can choose to turn and go to San Francisco. It's your decision. Well, in organizing, remember, the only reason we're organizing is to accomplish objectives. So if our objective is L.A., and we say, if you get on this road, we think we're going to get there, then organizing attempts to channel our efforts so that we can end up at L.A. and not San Francisco, unless you want to. And then you've got a choice to pull out. Okay? Let's take a look at some biblical examples of organizing. I'm going to cover these quickly. First of all, I'd like to take a look at some examples from the Old Testament. I'll just give you some references and let you look these up for yourself. Numbers 3, verse 5 through 10. We see a job description for Levites. Bet you didn't know they had a job description spelled out. Numbers 10, we see that Israel is organized for moving. Tribes are all laid out there as to how they're going to move. If you look at Numbers 2, you'll see that they're organized for camping. They go into the detail of how to set up camp. Deuteronomy 16, we see that judges are appointed to rule over people. 1 Chronicles 23, we come back to the Levites again, and the whole chapter talks about the duties and responsibilities of the Levites. See, they had natural questions too. What is my job? And so this was an attempt by God to answer that question for them. Let's turn to the New Testament, some other examples of organizing. Luke 9:14, we see the feeding of the 5,000 in groups of 50. I guess you could have done it one mass, but the Lord chose to use groups of 50. Titus 1:5, we see that elders have been appointed in every city to provide leadership. And then, of course, Acts 6, we see that 7 were set aside for administration. 1 Corinthians 12:18, we see the placement of members of Christ in his body to carry out his role on earth. And it's interesting that the body was chosen. Did you ever wonder about that? Why the human body was chosen to express how God would operate on the earth after Christ left? Well, I don't know if you've ever thought about it this way, but my arm's got a pretty clear job description. It can only go this way. It's hard to come back around this way, so it can only operate in this one direction. And my eye, it's tried to hear many times, but all it can do is see. And it's clear. It's clear exactly what this responsibility is and what this one is. There's no messing around. Well, it's interesting that the Lord chose the body to express how we're supposed to work together, that they're very distinct responsibilities, so that when we put them together, we will be able to move out and accomplish His work. Now, we're still talking about why to organize. We've seen some practical reasons. We've seen some biblical examples. And I think it's interesting to reflect back on the history of evangelism and take a look at the role that organization has played in the last several centuries in the history of evangelism. There's a book out by Paula Scharf. He wrote it for the World Congress of Evangelism in Berlin in 1966. Billy Graham endorses the book, so I assume it's pretty straight. And I like to read two quotes from the book. Now, what he did, he took a look at the history of evangelism from the time of Luther up through now. By the way, I think we got one line in there on Campus Crusade. But anyhow, he took a look at the movement of evangelism and talked about what happened, why it happened, and then he tried to draw some summaries from it. It's an interesting book if you have time to go through it. History of Evangelism by Paula Scharf. And I won't go into a lot of other points. So many good points out of that book. But I'd just like to read this quote that he had. What gave Methodist evangelism its strength and enduring effectiveness? First of all, there was a secret working of the Holy Spirit. In addition, there were three factors especially. First, the faithful preaching of Wesley and his co-workers. Secondly, Wesley's unusual organizational ability. And thirdly, Wesley's strong motivation to bring salvation to all lands and peoples. Wesley's daily schedule was closely regulated and included specific periods of prayer. A veritable army of lay preachers and exhorters supported him. But the significance of Wesley stems only in part from his preaching. It stems even more from his gift as an organizer. Whitfield was the spiritual soil and furnished the building materials. Wesley was the architect who fashioned everything into a new structure. Then another quote referring to Moody. What was the secret of Moody's great success and of lasting fruit of his work? Besides the working of God's Spirit, there were several special factors. Like Wesley and Finney, Moody was a gifted organizer. Every campaign followed a definite program. Important, too, were Moody's contributions and careful follow-up work and that of training personal workers who could deal with the awakened and the seekers. Often at the end of his campaigns, Moody set up workshops to discuss pertinent subjects, such as how to conduct prayer meetings, how to do follow-up work, how to nurture new converts, how to train lay people as workers, how to reach the unchurched. You know, you hear the how-tos again. That's interesting. Such workers' meetings were characteristic of Moody's evangelistic endeavors. He believed in strengthening a seed of personal responsibility among preachers and laymen for saving souls, and for training and equipping co-workers. He was convinced that to win 10 for the work was better than to do the work of 10. And then one last quote from Moody, John Mott learned to prepare everything to the last detail in organizing his meetings. Now, Mott is the one who organized or founded the famous student volunteer movement at the turn of the century. And this is a movement that Moody referred to as the greatest revival since Pentecost. And I guess in 1940 they had something, many thousands were involved in this work. So I just wanted you to see the perspective or the role that organizing has played in God's working through the last centuries. Now let's talk about some principles of organizing. We've been talking about why it makes sense to organize. Let's talk about some principles of organizing. Now, you can come up with a lot of principles, but I'd like to suggest that there are some very basic ones. First of all, and those of you that have been working with us this year are getting sick and tired of this phrase, organizing follows planning. Or another way of expressing that is strategy before structure. Strategy before structure. It's an interesting book out. If you have nothing to do and are bored to death, you can read it. But it takes a look at some of the major corporations in America and traces their history. And every single case, all the way, it takes General Motors, Sears, Roebuck, many of the other big ones, and it shows you how this principle has been invaluable to their becoming effective today. And I'd like to take a look at Sears Roebuck to demonstrate this principle. Started out back in the 1800s, late 1800s, and it was in one field of business. in the mail order business. They were convinced that to saturate the U.S., the best way to do that was to open up a mail order business, and it was very effective. Then several years thereafter, a fellow by the name of General Wood came along, and he said, you know, he said, as I look at the future, as I look at the effect of the automobile on our society, I'm convinced that retailing will become an important part of getting goods to consumers. So General Wood introduced retailing. Now let's look at what happened. Mail order business, where you essentially set up operations to just have people respond, write in for something, and then you ship it out. And then General Wood comes along and he says, well, now let's set up retailing. So that's precisely what they did. I won't go into a lot of details, but the structure that they came up with did not reflect this change in strategy. They came up with a structure which still had two basic units of operating, mail order and the retailing. Where the rubber met the road was out in the field. You got one guy operating there in a mail order business, and down the block is a guy in the retailing business, and you talk about hitting heads. They hit heads. And they hit heads for 15 years. And General Wood tried experiment after experiment of what kind of organization would enable them to get the job done. And it was only until after the Second World War, the last great war, that they realized that, you know, we've essentially changed our strategy. In place of just trying to reach people mail order and then throw in a little retailing, we've essentially said that consumers will respond two ways. And so then they began to set up a structure which would enable that to happen. Now, as I said, there are many other examples, but you see this over and over again. Many problems with organizing is that you don't understand what your strategy is. You haven't clearly said what your strategy is. And the more clearly you define your strategy, exactly how you're going to do something, you'll find your organization falls right out of that. In Campus Crusade, we've essentially said we want a major U.S. movement. But as a subpart of that, we want four major thrusts in the U.S., our military, our lay, our high school, and our campus. And then we're going to have some other things helping out these major areas, our athletic ministry and some others. Then we said another major grouping will be our overseas ministry. So you see, what we try to do with our organization is to identify what our strategy is. A very important principle. Second point, recognize natural groupings. You know, there's no secret to organizing. I call it common sense personified. It's just a matter of recognizing what natural groupings you have. If this needs to be next to this in order to get the job done, then put it there. It doesn't need to be next to this one. And organizing is taking a look at everything you got going on and saying, now how can we group these things together so that they can work better? Third point, keep it simple. Keep it simple. I've seen organization charts that you would think would be a wedding cake for Rockefeller. You know, they're stacked up, and what they lose sight of is all the actions down here. You know, if you're selling an item, let's take Sears Roebuck. There's one crucial activity, and that is when the consumer comes into the store to buy something. That's where the action is. Everything else is designed to make sure that when he comes in, he can get the right material. That's all it is. So the more layers you stack up there, the more your leadership is separated from where the action is. Now, on the other hand, if you got too many things laid out this way, trying to be operated by one person, you'll have chaos. So there's a balance, but always try to keep your organizing simple. And then a fourth point that Dr. Hendricks mentioned was we organize to meet needs. Try to organize to meet needs. I've seen so many theoretical organizational charts that they're coming out my ears. And I always come in and say, well, what needs are you trying to meet? So you can plan to reach objectives, but you need to organize to meet needs. My fifth point, you need to be as specific as possible when you're assigning responsibilities. Now, we'll go into much more detail on some of these points a little later. So we're going to move a little faster here. Organizing only begins on paper. I've seen guys with a tremendous organization chart on paper. They come to me a couple weeks later and say, man, it's not working. You got to realize that organizing is involving people, and it only begins on paper. You got to communicate. You've got to motivate. You've got to develop the people. Sell them on your organization. And I'm going to throw in a PS here because I have the prerogative during this hour to speak. Do not misuse committees. I think one of the common errors that we make is to misuse committees. Committees are designed for pooling ideas, for pooling experience, and for advising. They're tremendous as advising. But you know what they're not designed to do? They're not designed to make decisions, and they're certainly not designed to implement decisions. I've seen committees labor for days and days trying to decide how to implement something. Well, committees are designed to pool together your common experience and resources. Now, sometimes you'll need to use committees to make decisions, but be aware that they're not really designed for making decisions. That's what the human mind is for, and that's why one person, God usually chose to work through one man. He was going to have a big movement, like Moses bringing the children of Israel out. Moses didn't work on a committee basis. God looked to Moses to get the job done. And I think the more we realize that people have got to start making decisions, the better you'll see your effort increase. In other words, you'll see a freeing up of people. Now, I'd like to cover one last example, and then we'll be taking a break. I've seen Nehemiah used many different ways. And therefore, I'd like to use him one other way. I'd like to call Nehemiah the organizer. He's been called a planner, and probably by his wife he was called a lot of other things. But I'd like to call him the organizer. Now, let me give you a little background. I'm sure you're all familiar with the name of the king that sent Nehemiah back to his town, Artaxerxes I. This is about 450 B.C., as was mentioned the other morning by Dr. Hendricks again. Took only two examples. Man's got a wealth of experience to draw from and took my only two examples. Okay. This is a year's worth of work here. I have to get back in the Word. Okay, let's focus in on Nehemiah, and then we'll close off and take a little coffee break. We first of all see that he's in a position, a privileged position, as we brought out the other day, to the king there, and then he receives permission to return to Jerusalem. And about 445 B.C., if you want to put that on your calendar, long-range calendar, back it up to 445 B.C., you see that he was appointed governor. And then the book of Nehemiah is an example of his personal memoirs. Now, since I had a little more preparation time, I can lay down a chart on this thing. Actually, I had this chart yesterday, but I didn't tell him I had it. Now, I want you to get some idea of what size wall we got here. According to my research, my tape measure, it comes to about 4 miles all the way around. Now, I want you to get an idea of what 4 miles is. Let's say you began down in the village, okay? And you had to start making a wall, and you came up the hill, and then you went down the hill, and you went almost down to the guardhouse, okay, at the bottom of the hill. And then you cut back down to the administration building. And then you jumped over to Bill's house. And then from Bill's house, you came around the back side and joined the village again. I haven't stepped that off recently, but that would come to about 4 miles, give or take a little bit. So that's kind of the distance we're talking about. It's essentially enclosing most of the grounds around at Arrowhead Springs. That's about 4 miles. That's what he was working with. Okay? Now, I'd like to get in a word here. I'd like to look at some points from Nehemiah the organizer. First of all, in chapter 2, as was brought out the other day, when he gets there, he makes a little nocturnal inspection. I probably wouldn't have used that term to express what he did, but essentially came out of the valley gate, went around over here, couldn't stand it over there, so he came back here. Well, they have some interesting names here, don't they? Okay. The first thing, now I think what this shows us is when we begin to organize, I think we fall into the trap of organizing before we have a definite objective. So you notice the first thing he does is he takes a look at what's going on, and it says he doesn't say nothing to nobody when he comes in. You can imagine here's an arrival from Artaxerxes himself, and everybody's wondering, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And it says he doesn't do anything until he has a chance to check out the ground. And that's what we need to really focus in on. Before we start talking about organizing, we need to make sure that we've got a definite objective. Okay, and then in chapter 3, we see that what he does is he takes natural groupings, in other words, families, and he puts them together. Now, if you count up the number of groupings in chapter 3, you come to about 49. We'll round that off at 50. So it would be taking a group like this. We've got about 300, and you'd be breaking up in groups of 6. And if you multiply that out long wise on a piece of paper, you come out to the 300. Which would take up this whole group. So now, if you each had to break, let's see, about half of your table. Now let's picture this wall now going around Arrowhead Springs. And you had to be assigned a certain part of that wall. That's about the situation that he was faced with. Now these men had a lot more help in those groupings. They had all kind of kids running around wanting to put this, that, you know, someplace. And but that's essentially the number of groups that he used. He used about 49 or 50 groups then. Then also in chapter 3, we see that he was interested in defining very clearly what their responsibilities would be, as was mentioned the other morning. And then he also was concerned about strategic placement. In other words, he was concerned that if a guy lived here, he gave him this thing to work on. And interestingly enough, his motivation would be pretty high. So he was concerned with strategic placement. Now, again, if you take chapter 3, Nehemiah left me. I didn't think it was that early in the Bible. Okay, if you take chapter 3 and you read verse 1, it says the high priest rose up with his brethren, the priest, and they built the sheep gate. So in verse 1, he starts with the sheep gate. And if you turn to the last verse in chapter 3, it says, in between the upper chamber of the corner and the sheep gate, the goldsmiths and the merchants repaired. In other words, he didn't make assignments on a random basis. He started at the sheep gate, and I don't know if he went that way or that way, but essentially what he did was to go right around that old sheep gate and come right all the way around making assignments, and he ended up back at the sheep gate. So he was systematic in his assignment of responsibility. Okay, and then I'd like to read something in chapter 4, verse 6, referring to Nehemiah the organizer. So we built the wall, and all the wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. Now here's an interesting observation. If I put Eddie Waxer on one of these teams that'd be working on this wall around Arrowhead, and let's say I put Bill Hogan heading up the other team, I'm sure Eddie would be motivated to try to get his section up before Bill even got started. In fact, he'd be working night and day to say, hey, I finished my section. And but let's look at what happened here. It says, and all the wall was joined together to half its height. In other words, the way they built it was not just for one guy to take his section and begin to build up the whole thing, but it rose evenly all the way around. And at one point here in verse 6 of chapter 4, it says that the wall was built up to half its height all the way around. Now that implies a degree of coordination that I wonder if we could get out of this group if we tried to build a similar wall. In other words, when Bill's not reaching his height, and Eddie would be taking time off to help him a little bit. So the wall rose up evenly. And that is an example of coordination. Now also, let's take a look at verse 10 of chapter 4. But Judah said, the strength of the burden bearers is failing, and there is much rubbish. We are not able to work on the wall. In other words, somebody need to make a provision for the frontline troops. The frontline troops were out there building on the wall, but there was all kind of rubbish accumulating in the background. And then we read in verse 16, the same chapter, From that day on, half of my servants worked on construction, and half held the spears, shields, bows, and coats of mail. In other words, what Nehemiah did was to set aside some people to meet that particular need of cleaning up the mess as they were building. So he was making a provision for the frontline troops. Verse 17, I think, is very interesting. And as we go this afternoon into job descriptions and the workshops, I think this has particular meaning for us. Verse 17. Those who carried burdens were laden in such a way that each one had, each with one hand labored on the work and with the other hand held his weapon. And I would like to propose that here we have the first example of a juggler. In Campus Crusade, many times we're asked to, with one hand, do this and with one hand, do that, and you've got to juggle some balls. And I'm convinced that this is probably the first place for the biblical principle of juggling balls, and that one guy, while he was doing this, had to also have his hand on this. And I think that's an important principle that we'll talk about later. And then, as was mentioned earlier, in verse 15 and 16, the objective again, coming back to the whole idea of why we're organizing. Take a look at that again. It's a process where you place people into a structure to accomplish objectives. Only reason you're organizing. And then in verse 15, the objective was reached in 52 days. And as Dr. Hendricks pointed out, in verse 16, even the enemies knew it was of God. And I guess the application in our lives is, if people were watching us, would they know that our accomplishments were of God?